Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to share their time, their insights, and their expertise to enable us all to grow our businesses. My name is Gary Lafferty, your host and creator and founder of the Authority Accelerators, where we help founders in the tech industry close more powerful relationships, build better deals, and be seen and heard as the authority within their field. Now, on this episode, I can't wait to get started and dive in because I've got a fantastic guest for you. We're going to be talking about a complete gear shift in career to founder. How do you become a founder and then grow to start working with enterprise clients? More importantly, mindset shifts and also marketing shifts. So there's a lot we're going to be talking about today, and I can't wait to get into it. So without further ado, before I start stumbling over my words, Molly, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here today. Why don't we start off with just introducing yourself? Tell us who you are and what is it that you do?
Hi, Gary. It is so great to be on this podcast with you. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Molly, and I am one of the co-founders and CEO of a company called Perigee. And my quick background is before founding Perigee, I was a mathematician at the NSA. And then right out of NSA, I came and founded the company. And we're essentially an enterprise integration and automation platform. And what we're really good at is connecting to all of the siloed systems within these big organizations like sales systems, accounting, inventory, and helping to automate a lot of the manual work that people are doing today, the things that they're doing that to get visibility or run processes. There's a lot more you can do with automation, AI, augmentation, and that's what we do.
Well, that's great. We're going to dive a lot more into that as we get on into this episode. But I always like to dial it a little bit back into the beginning. So as you said, you made the leap from the NSA to founding Perigee. Number one, what was the biggest shift you had to make to go from the NSA to becoming a first-time founder?
The biggest mindset shift that I had to make, I think the first one was realizing, you know, I've always been really mission driven. Ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a spy, in part because it seemed like that was like the most noble honorary thing you could do. And then I got to NSA and realized, wow, I think I just hit my dream job at 22. You know, what is the next horizon to keep being mission driven? How do I take the things that I'm doing here and get even bigger? And that's where the mindset shift came from, was reflecting on, wow, it seems like the next arena that is bigger than something as big as a global agency like the NSA is starting your own company and making waves in an industry that you don't have any credibility to be in and don't have any contacts or any network and having to build from there. So that was a pretty big mindset shift. I could touch on a couple other ones, but I think that was the biggest one that I had to realize that was the North Star that drove me to want to found a company and be mission focused in that way.
Well, I love that. I love the fact that, you know, you want to be mission focused from that. You wanted to be a spy. I didn't even know that about you. So now I know something extra about you. You know, so it's like, so one of these things about shifting from where you were, where you thought the trajectory was going to go with your career, then you shifted again, you became a first-time founder. But that's not the first shift, was it? Because, sorry, that wasn't the be-all and end-all of shifts. You are a person that's had to make shifts as you go along, just like every other entrepreneur. So you started Perigee with one focus in mind, and then you pivoted based upon market demand. Why? Can you just explain to us where you were going, what happened, and then where did you end up going?
This is a conversation I was having recently with like another founder that, you know, the tech crunches of the world, the entrepreneur magazines, like you always hear the most crisp version of the story. I think every founder has the 6 to 10 things that they tried that didn't work. So there's a couple, like I could name a couple of iterations of like, how do I get this company off the ground? What is it is that I'm trying to do? The most notable one is when I was, Perigee essentially started really focused on this space within cybersecurity called operational technology. And if you are familiar with like Colonial Pipeline, when we had this huge, this whole nobody could get gas on the East Coast because some systems were hacked. That was essentially like what is called like an operational technology hack. It's like all the things that are running power grids and utilities. And we started really focused on that problem. But in working closely with customers and listening, always listening, we found that this architecture that we built that was so good at connecting to some really hard legacy systems and automating work around them had actually even more utility, more excitement, even like bigger applications and broader applications for the same companies when applied to just regular IT systems. And so we made this transition from, hey, we're not going to only focus on this like operational parts of the business, we're going to focus on all parts of the business. That was a pretty big shift for us. And it was, I'd say, on so many levels, you're dealing with, my goodness, I'm trying to manage a team, I'm trying to manage a product, I'm trying to manage my own identity, somebody who's built up thinking we were doing one thing and now I'm trying to rethink about myself in this other space. But so grew a lot in that.
That's a really interesting thing, you know, because you said you've got to manage yourself as well as a founder, as an entrepreneur. Then there'll be other people who are watching this and listening to this particular episode, Molly, who'll be thinking, oh, I'm thinking of changing, or, you know, am I wrong to change because I've put all this time and effort into this particular direction, into this trajectory, and now I think it's the wrong one, or I need to sort of have a different iteration. What advice would you give other founders who are listening, who are facing similar situations, that should they or shouldn't they, or what is the thing to do if they do recognize it's time to pivot?
Yeah, I think there's a third group that you didn't mention, which is people who should change but don't realize it. And I think, taking a step forward and then a step back, you know, one thing that I took away from this is having so much more clarity and so much more perception into what are the situations where maybe you need to change. And not everything is going to be as big and strategic as like, what are you selling to customers? But I'd like to think I'm a lot more decisive in smaller moments as a result of having gone through this. But having gone through it, you know, what advice would I give to people? I think a really big thing was first being just to be able to label the problem and have everybody be able to talk about it in the same way. It genuinely felt like there was a little bit of time where we didn't have a direction, which is really scary because your whole job as a CEO is to have a direction. And I had to sit down with the team and be like, guys, the job to do right now is to find a direction. And that's okay. That is the thing. But in that, we then, and then of course we get closer and like you start to define it. But that was the first step. And then from there, we made really small goals. Not small goals, but like very tangible, extremely measurable goals. And we're very held ourselves accountable to making sure that we hit them. And if we didn't hit them, that's okay. We need to try something else. And we need to make sure that this next phase is working. So like, for example, it was like, hey, in the next four weeks, we need to get 5 users into the platform under this new strategic vision. And if we can't do that, then we need to rethink all the different components, the product, messaging, et cetera. But if we can do that, then we're going to find the next stretch goal. And obviously in startups, like you're always trying to have goals. You know, sometimes you pick the wrong goals and that's okay. But I do think that this particular inflection points, it's important not to shy away from that. Like lean into them. They're going to help everybody be rowing in the same direction at a time when it can be hard to keep everyone going in the same direction.
Yeah, you know, that's such an important piece of advice there, listening to you just talk about it's okay to just dial it back sometimes and not just keep your foot on the gas all the time. Sometimes you say, okay, let's just stop. And what is the first sprint we need to do? Then what is the second sprint we need to do without feeling guilty that you're not achieving what you need to achieve? Because as you say, if you don't get that foundation right, you can't really pivot. And then you're heading into a direction you don't want to get into. So I think great advice and great insights there. That being said, like I love what you said earlier. One of your sprints was, how do we get, you know, 5 people on into the new way we're doing things? And it comes down to selling. And like tech, always in this industry, tech and sales don't usually go together. Tech people are very tech orientated and really try and shy away from sales where they can. But it's an odd industry because there's an awful lot of founder-led sales in order to drive the company forward. So what has been one lesson, Molly, about selling as a founder that you believe more people need to hear?
I'm gonna give a two-part answer. One, I don't know if this is advice. Some advice you just have to learn the hard way is advice that someone once gave me. Like, you're not going to understand it until you live through it. I genuinely now can appreciate how much sales is about relationships. I think that when I entered into this sales role, I thought that I had to be somebody different than who I was. And I thought that I had to like read books and sound like a salesperson and talk like a salesperson and like do all these activities like a salesperson. And there's some bare minimum that I'm going to, like some tactical things that I did pick up that we will come back to. But I think what I've taken away from it now is like, oh, there's so much more room to be yourself in a sales process and still get a sale done. You don't have to somehow be disingenuous because it is about relationships. It is about you know, building trust and like listening to the person and trying to and adjusting as a result. So that's like one thing. If you think you can't sell because you think you can't be a salesperson, I'd say there's just no one way to be a salesperson. And like, that's okay. The second piece though, is I did pick up some real technical things. I used to think that you had to like wait until the POC was done to talk about contracting as a quick example. No, as soon as the POC starts, start talking about contracting, maybe even before is one example. I used to think that the customer should set the next steps on the call. No. Say what you want the next step to be in the first 3 minutes and then repeat them again in the last 3 minutes of the call and say, are those the right next steps to do? And so those are just some small tactical things that, again, I don't think make you any less of a founder, any less pure about what you're trying to do. It's just more guideposts on, you know, how do you grow? How do you move something forward that nobody has any rubric to move forward before. No one has ever bought your product before. No one's ever sold it before. You've got to define the playbook. Those are just some practical things that have really helped.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna come back to one because you dropped an absolute gold nugget there. And for those who think, what was it that you gave? Let me retrace that for you. Just setting the next step agenda for your prospect, for your customer, is enough for them to start thinking, what is that next step? Mm-hmm. Rather than leaving it to the customer, leaving it to the client to think, what is the next step? You know, as you said, what is the next step? Get it out first. Where this is the next step after our call, after our meeting, and then repeat it at the very end. I absolutely love that. And I think if people could just pick up one thing from this today, that should be on their list. Absolutely, they should be on their list. And this is the key thing. Sales cycles in tech are getting longer. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those things. More and more people are now involved in the sales cycle, in the buying process. What strategies, apart from making sure there's a next step, what strategies have you found to be really effective in keeping deals moving forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, say the next steps, just to harp on it. If someone is like, what is she talking about? Here's how you say it. You go like this. You say, if you're interested and if this is going well, here's how we'll do this next. And you just kind of put them in the headspace. It's very easy, I promise. All right, what are other things? Man, I spun so many cycles on like, do we offer POCs? Do we not offer POCs? Obviously, in a perfect world, you wouldn't. Like, why? You wouldn't. I have since come down on the fact that like, at least at this stage of the company, we can do it so fast and we can show some real value on a product that is totally, not unproven, but like they don't have a bunch of market data points to point to. It's not like you're buying IBM. And that's really helpful. And where I'm going with this is it helps. I've actually felt like it helps speed up the sales process because in this POC, you can break off like a burning pain point for them and you solve it for them and they use your product and that actually helps to drive the sales forward. And so I think some people had given me advice and I had tried so many different things of like, oh, it's going to make things longer. You're going to get stuck in POC purgatory. It's going to create all these different legal things. And what I found, it actually helps create momentum. And it really helps seal the deal because you have something you can point to that they don't want to be taken away.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. That really is. So let's talk about, this is a nice little segue from what you've just been saying about that sales cycle and making sure that you're remaining in control of that. You work with mid-sized to Fortune 50 companies, you know, as a relatively new startup as well. How have you managed to land these enterprise clients without a huge sales team?
That is correct. How have we managed it? I'd say the processes look very similar for both. Like the time between them is different. The paperwork between them is different. There are some lessons learned about, you know, dealing with these big enterprises have these huge legal contracts that you have to sort of subscribe to as opposed to someone else subscribing to your contract. So that was like, I didn't know that before coming into this. And maybe when we're bigger, that's not true. But right now, that's how it works. How did we land the big Fortune 50s? I think that like, it looks so similar. You build a relationship with somebody and you find usually the person that is going to be your buyer is maybe different from the person that you're working that's going to ultimately own the tool, which is a little bit different in the mid-sized companies. You're kind of like in the same, you don't need to have these multi-threads. And so then you kind of start to parallel track it. And I'd say the only thing that is maybe different is like how you're trying to keep constant relationships with all these, you're just keeping relationships with more parties in the bigger enterprises, right, than in smaller. And it's helpful if when you've had one or two under your belt And you can start to anticipate what is going to be a part of the process. Like, hey, with these other companies, I think that the legal team can take 6 months. Does it make sense for us to get started today? Even though I know, you know, we're just beginning, but like, I think that, you know, we want to make sure we have everything ready. So those are the big differences, and is like more relationships. You just want to make sure that you've got FaceTime with, and trying to get a head start on certain legal processes and paperwork and as much as possible, just because everything takes longer. And as we know, things are taking longer, just more generally.
Yes, they are. And yeah, as I said, one thing, again, I love that little bit of insight there that, you know, by telling them and showing them the prospect, what they need to do to buy, almost advising them on what the buying process is. Like, oh, well, this is going to take 6 months. So this is where I'm casting the path out for them, showing them where that path is. Then obviously you say, once you had one or two of those deals done, it's a lot easier to cherry pick from those previously to move forward. So that's definitely a lovely piece of insight there. So let's talk about standing out, because until you can have these conversations, before you can have these conversations, you need to stand out above all the noise. And with so much noise in AI and automation space today, how do you make sure that your message apparently stands out in this kind of really crowded, noisy space?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two inflection points, or like there's two phases where you need to stand out. We're admittedly in a slightly easier phase now because we have customers that we can point to and real AI case studies with real ROI. And it seems like everyone's trying to leverage AI, but no one's getting a lot of value out of it. And we're able to point to these case studies and be like, but this is where it's providing, you know, 10x, 100x ROI on the input. So that's huge. Up until then, like, it's very hard. It's a whole chicken and egg problem, right? Like, you need to stand out, but you need those types of stories to be able to stand out. I'm trying to think like back to that stage of the company and how we finally got it. I think it just came back to, at least for us, it was working with design partners, and truthfully, some of them didn't work out. Like, and that's okay. Not everybody that got us to our first customer is still with us today. And that I look to, I'm like, yeah, but you know, some people just come into your life for a point of time for a reason. And like, that's awesome. And then you kind of grow from that. And then you kind of leapfrog that. So I'd say it's okay. What I would tell those people who are kind of like in the early stages, it's awesome to think about, how am I going to get to 10 customers? How am I going to get to 100? What do you need to get to 1? And like, just focus on that, and then focus on the next thing, which is 5, and then it's 10, and then it's 100. Because what you need to do to get to that might be a little bit different for what you need for the next stage. And I think that is true at every stage of the company, that you're constantly kind of rewriting what got you from point A to point B and how it's going to get you to point C.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, as you grow, whether you're going from 1 million to 5 million to 10 million to 20 million, there are different processes that you need to put into place. There's different ways of doing things, of marketing and for selling and relationship. All of those change as we go along. But one thing seems to be a very big constant is LinkedIn. LinkedIn has been a great tool for many within the tech space for outreach and generating business. What's work? I know you're a great believer of LinkedIn. What's working for you right now with regards to your LinkedIn strategy?
Oh, yes. I am on LinkedIn all the time. I probably have at least 10 browsers open right now, and I forgot to close them out, and I'm worried that like this is going to get some ping on this. Let's see. Obviously, like, LinkedIn is awesome for like content marketing, like everybody knows that. And, you know, the more you can do, the better. Obviously, at some point, it's better to even be targeted at some point. But in my mind, to any founder who's like looking for advice, I would try to not over-optimize for like the exact right thing. Just like general swelling of the base is good for LinkedIn. That's like kind of my mentality. Maybe somebody would disagree and be like, no, you should only be more strategic about that. But I personally think that that's probably like more time than it's worth than just like the marginal benefit of doing that versus just getting your name out there. Like, just do something. In terms of, I use LinkedIn for a lot of cold outreach, and I find it an awesome and cheap, not cheap is like relatively inexpensive way to try out new messaging. That's like the biggest way that I want to use LinkedIn is I want to use it to book meetings, but more importantly, I want to know why I'm booking those meetings. And so we have yet to do a lot of automation with LinkedIn, in part because it's, you know, you could go buy a service and, you know, they're going to tell you they're going to book 30 meetings for you. They're going to send 2,000 messages. but we have like certain personas that we want to reach, and we want to try out 5 different messages on them. And we want to try those same 5, you know, 3 of those messages on this other persona to figure out if it's like the same message would work for 2. Anyway, there's all these different things. I've got all these spreadsheets keeping track. That is a winning combination to me for why to use LinkedIn. And you can be a lot more targeted than if you were to use Google Ads or, I don't know, a landing page or something else wouldn't give you as much fidelity into your strategy.
I just want to stay on LinkedIn because I'm glad you said that. It is far better than this kind of the blanket ads going out there where you're not necessarily hitting the right type of demographic that you want. When it comes to LinkedIn, and LinkedIn has got even more noisier, it has. Whichever way we look at it, over the last probably 18 months, we've seen LinkedIn turn from a real connection relationship-based platform to almost like a semi-advert platform now where everyone's giving little tips and things. Everyone's trying to gain the numbers, as it were. Mm-hmm. With regards to how you're doing, I love the way you just put the brakes on it and say, yeah, we haven't automated it. We're sticking to the one-to-one, getting those messages and relationships out. Can I just dive a little bit deeper into the testing, like you said? Because there'll be people listening who could probably benefit from, you know, a basic understanding of how you are using split testing, different messaging within the LinkedIn. Could you share a little bit more about that for us?
Yeah, definitely. All right. So I do it on a monthly basis. Like I do it every single week, and then I keep track within a week. I roll up the metrics on a monthly basis, and then I kind of roll up on a monthly into a quarterly, et cetera. So that's how it's organized. And then I like to do experiment, like some combination of experiments where I'm usually running them on like a weekly basis. Like, hey, this week I want to test, you know, this, you know, for us, it's like IT leaders at this size company in this industry. And I want to try these 3 messages against, you know, and I usually work in batches of 30 because I'm a mathematician, and like 30 is like the statistical number that like is magic as opposed to 25. And LinkedIn has a max of like 200 messages you can send a week. So you can kind of run like around 6 experiments or so every week. So anyway, I do that. And so that's sort of the heartbeat of it is like that type of method. And where I'm getting the messages and where I'm getting the personas is usually some combination of, hey, we just won this new customer and we want to see if the value the way that customer is describing the value to us, would that work on the next 30 people? That's like a, you know, we're running a lot of experiments like that. The other type of experiments is like, you know, we're seeing, you know, there's a customer over here that we just won, and we're curious to know if it works for somebody in a slightly different industry or a slightly bigger company. So it's like, there's the repeatability of it, and then there's the expandability of it. And I'm usually running every single one of my experiments is usually trying to do one of those 2 things, for the different types of people, like the different permutations of our customer base and, you know, what we know to be true of our ICP.
Yeah. And I'm going to repeat it for those listening. The experimentation part, rather than just the blanket connection request, I love the word that you use was experimentation about it. And I think people listening, I think if they can just take a little bit out of that and go, that's a really interesting point. I might try that. I would advise people, you know, certainly to give that a go. So let's talk about the need for speed. It's one of those things which every founder and every entrepreneur tends to jump on this bandwagon, that they need the need for speed in a startup to get things going, to get it post revenue. How do you balance, or how have you balanced the need for speed to get it going and to become viable? We're building a solid, scalable foundation from which you can now grow.
Yeah, I think that I look at it both in terms of input and output. Speed for the sake of speed is not going to help anybody. And so I do measure, I have good days and bad days. And like a good day is like when my output is good. It doesn't mean I did it. It's like the output is good. I booked some number of meetings or like this sales call converted, you know. And so I measure speed. For me, speed is not a function of like how many hours I worked during the day. It's like, how many things did I get done before lunch? And if I can do if I can move the business before lunch, and like there are tangible things like that to me feel like moving the business, like if I can do it before lunch, like that's good. And then I have to do it after lunch, and I have to do it in the evenings. And like I have 3 chunks of my day where I have to like physically move the thing, and there has to be something that created some. And I like have really high bars for myself. It has to be like text, like this. this thing got more valuable today because of this. That doesn't happen every day, but that is my bar every single day when I wake up and what I hold myself to. And then, so that's the output that is like most important to me, because it's like speed for the sake of speed is not going to help. On the input side, I do feel like I think about the company all the time, and I don't like to use, like, I'm just one of those people that is like, if there is a free time on my weekend on a plane that, you know, it doesn't make sense to be moving the business, then I'm like, I'm watching calls, I'm reflecting, I'm thinking, I'm like, I'm in our books looking at like, where can we be more efficient? Where can we be driving growth? Like, I really try to use spare cycles to think holistically about the business, and then use those different chunks of my day to be like pushing. and that's usually, I think that would probably be, I'm like, I'm either pushing or I'm pulling. And pushing happens 3 times a day, and pulling happens in the moments in between where you get a little bit of a break. And I don't want to let any cycles go to waste.
No, you're really utilizing your time effectively there, you know, making sure. And I love the fact that you said the input and the output when pushing, making sure you have those needle movers in your business so that, you know, it's as an exit founder, I've got to say, you just nailed that little comment earlier about, you probably didn't even realize you said it. But for those who at least caught it, was like, I've made it more valuable today. And I just love that. If you can keep pushing and making your business, the asset, more valuable, then you know you're doing the right thing. So that being said, Molly, looking ahead, what really excites you most about the future of Perigee and your industry?
I'm going to start with which one do I want to start with? I'll start with Perigee because that's like the one that I think about the most. And then I'll talk about the industry. I am so excited and twofold. I'm so excited for how our customers are expanding within our platform. It is so, wow. For the first time last week, we heard someone say like, hey, I'm tying my employees' performance objectives to like being successful in your platform and like using it. And like, I was like, wow, we have made it. We are part of someone's performance objectives. Like, that is so cool that we are like ingrained in this. And I'd say, you know, 80 to 90% of our customers, like, we're showing up on their board decks, regard like the Fortune 50 companies as well, as like being part of their strategic vision. And I'm so excited to grow with them, like genuinely, and how they're using it. And they have some of like the most, like, we are visionaries, and then they come along and are visionaries with us and how they're going to use it. So that's going to be a big year for us in expanding on that. And then obviously, like, getting to repeat that with new customers too, with all the learnings that we have with them and that I'm so grateful for, is very exciting. For the industry, I'd say, so we're in this like integration automation space. It is growing really fast. And it seems like everybody is like on board that like, hey, AI can do a lot. Automation can do a lot. And I'm just excited that people, it seemed like, you know, even when I was at the NSA, AI was kind of a, like, we would kind of laugh when people said AI. It just like didn't feel like a real thing. And like, there's now been this whole change where people believe you can do something useful and powerful with it. It's still just really hard to get done. And we'd like to think of ourselves like as of that bridge. Like, if you can believe it can get done, you can do it in Perigee. But the more believers that come up into the world, like, the bigger this space can be for us and for everyone else. So I think this industry is changing because there's just every day there's a new believer who realizes that AI and automation is really powerful, and we love to talk to them.
That's fantastic. So what is the goal for Perigee in the next 12 months?
Let's see, big goal, growth, obviously, but the, you know, to caveat that, or to paint a picture of that, we are growing, and I think that we can make some really big waves in helping companies be the competitive advantage for all of our companies, for all of our customers. And so we're really excited about this like new type of category creation that we're making at this leading edge of automation. So beyond just like growth for the sake of growth, again, it's like, how do we grow into this new category for helping companies use their internal systems better in a way that allows them to differentiate from their competitors and be bigger and better as a result.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, listen, Molly, I've got one last loaded question for you, okay? And ask nearly every one of my guests this. So for you, if you could give young Molly, and it doesn't matter how young Molly is going to be, right? This is totally up to you. But if you could speak to young Molly and give young Molly one piece of advice on success, on the topics of success, what would that piece of advice be?
The advice that I'd give young Molly is just because you don't know how to do something doesn't mean you can't do it. And that's something that I live by every day because It's always something new you don't know how to do. And I would never want that to hold myself back. And I definitely wouldn't want that to hold anybody else back in those same shoes in growing a company.
Well, that's a fantastic piece of advice to end on. Well, Molly, if people want to get hold of you or potentially want to work with you or find out if there's any fit, how's the best way to get hold of you?
I am on LinkedIn every single day and I read all those things. So LinkedIn is awesome. I'm trying to think what else. That's probably the best way. And then genuinely, somebody who reads those. It's not just like a platitude. Reach out to me on LinkedIn. That sounds great.
I'll make sure that your LinkedIn is in the show notes so they could just one click and get hold of you. Well, thank you very much, Molly. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on today.
Awesome. It's been so great chatting with you, Gary.
Well, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a pleasure having you again for another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast. And as always, if you have taken one thing, and I'm sure you must have taken loads from today and from Molly, make sure you like, make sure you comment and write down what you picked up from today so that other people can learn from it as well. But more importantly, please make sure that you share. This is how we grow. When we have leaders like Molly and the others here sharing their insights, let's share those amongst others so that we can all grow as entrepreneurs. So until the next episode, please make sure you keep striving. But more importantly, please make sure you are profitable. See you on the next episode. We'll be right back.